Tommy McNeil. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has rejected a call by more than 200 U.S. mayors to bring the Senate back into session and move on gun safety legislation. AP Sagar Magani reports the mayor has asked for the move after the two mass shootings that left 31 people dead last weekend.
In a letter to the Senate's two leaders, the mayor's urged them to interrupt a long August break and bring senators back to vote on House-passed bills expanding background checks for gun sales. Among those signing the letter, Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley, who said yesterday after President Trump's visit to her city, she'd like to finally see gun control action.
I'm not holding my breath. Too often we just see complete inaction because they're waiting just for time for people to forget.
Senate GOP Chief Mitch McConnell's been resisting pressure to bring lawmakers back. The president's been privately calling senators while pushing publicly for expanded background checks. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Dozens of immigrant workers have been released a day after being detained in the largest immigration raid in a decade in the United States. Immigrations and Customs Enforcement officials said 680 mostly Latino workers were arrested at seven Mississippi chicken processing plants in Wednesday's raids. But immigration lawyers say that by Thursday morning, about five busloads of people had been released. Mike Hurst is the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Mississippi.
Now, while we are a nation of immigrants, more than that, we are first and foremost a nation of laws.
Bill Chandler is the Executive Director of the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, speaking on WAPT-TV.
That's all in the name of white supremacy. They don't want people of color. They haven't figured out what to do with African Americans just yet, besides gerrymandering their districts. And now they don't want, they see a future where Latinos and other immigrants will bond together.
An ICE spokesman said about 30 of the workers were released at the plant. This is VOA News. As India and Kashmir remained in an unprecedented lockdown, Prime Minister Narendra Modi promised Kashmiris the beginning of a new era as a result of his government's decision to scrap the region's special status and bring it under New Delhi's control. In an address made on television and radio Thursday, Modi defended revoking the constitutional provision under which Kashmir could make its own laws, saying it has impeded its progress, given rise to terrorism, and was used as a weapon by rival Pakistan to instigate some people. He said India would now rid the region of terrorism and terrorists. New Delhi blames Islamabad for fomenting a violent three-decade separatist insurgency in the disputed Himalayan region that is claimed by both countries. With Kashmir in a communications blackout for the fourth straight day, it is not clear how residents of India's only Muslim-majority region reacted to the Hindu nationalist leader's assurances of more development, jobs, and better governance. Most Kashmiris could only have heard his speech on radio as internet and cable television networks remained suspended. A new report from the United Nations says how humans use land on the planet could help with climate change or could lead to catastrophe. AP's Rita Foley.
It's pretty scary. That's a UN climate change official talking who helped write the report. He says he's losing sleep over this. The report says within our lifetimes, the Earth could see food supplies dwindle, water shortages, and wildfires, just to name a few nightmares. French climate scientist Valérie Masson-Delmotte, who chaired one of the working groups, says we are doing this to ourselves.
The way we produce food and what we eat.
The scientists say we could help save the planet from a warmer future if we eat less meat, change the way we grow food, and stop cutting down as many trees. I'm Rita Foley.
In Zimbabwe, the president's son, a former first lady, and 24 other prominent politicians are accused of abusing their positions to acquire loans without collateral from a leading bank in the southern African country. The Commercial Bank of Zimbabwe says it has been forced to assume debt totaling at least $160 million after Emmerson Mnangagwa Jr., Grace Mugabe, and others defaulted on loans made from 2010 to 2014. It released a list of alleged defaulters earlier this week. Zimbabwe's government, overseeing the country's worst economy in a decade, has a 16% stake in the CBZ. Most of the individuals on the bank's list also allegedly defaulted on additional loans totaling $200 million from the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 9th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's president fires his controversial tourism minister for corruption.
I guess in terms of natural justice, she's innocent until she is proven guilty. But what it means is that she cannot conduct her duties as a cabinet minister because now she is in jail.
The United Nations says more than 190,000 South Sudan refugees have returned home from neighboring countries. Ebola fears slow border crossings and trade between Rwanda and the DRC. Cape Verde moves to combat drug trafficking in West Africa. And a judge orders the former chair of Nigeria's Elections Commission to appear in court today for a bill hearing.
It's good because it has shown that nobody is above the law, and no matter how long the crime is committed, definitely it will meet the rim of justice, no matter how long.
Minasura Ibrahim is a Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist. And slave legacy still haunts Angola and the United States 400 years after. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Thursday fired his controversial tourism minister, Prisca Mufumira, for corruption. Mufumira has been in jail since July this year after she was charged with corruption for her alleged role in a $95 million theft from the country's pension fund. She has denied the charges. Taban Nari is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups inside Zimbabwe. He says Mufumira was fired for what President Mnangagwa called conduct inappropriate for a government minister.
The president is saying that Prisca Mufumira did not. It has to do with the constitution. She has been accused of inappropriate conduct as a government minister. He is using the constitution because of the fact that she has done some inappropriate activities, mostly related to the National Social Security Administration Authority in Zimbabwe.
But at the request of the Anti-Corruption Commission, Ms. Mufumira, as much as we understand, is in jail now for corruption. So isn't that the duty of the courts now to take it up?
Well, I guess in terms of natural justice, she's innocent until she is proven guilty. But what it means is that she cannot conduct her duties as a cabinet minister because now she is in jail. And on that basis, the president did not suspend her, but he went on to fire her altogether.
But in legal terms, what does presumed innocent until proven guilty? What does that mean?
Well, it means that you have to go on with the court case. But there is also the issue about, public outlook, how people look at things. So even the fact that the minister has been accused in the first place, there's a forensic audit that came out that was done by chartered accountants who were mandated by the Auditor General of the Government of Zimbabwe. So just on the basis of that forensic audit, for starters, the minister should just have resigned herself. But in this instance, the president has gone on and fired her.
So if Ms. Mufumira is removed for conduct inappropriate for government minister, with corruption so rampant in many areas now in Africa, one should expect now that maybe more ministers are going to be fired.
Yes, so all that President Mnangagwa has done was just to whet the appetite of Zimbabweans. Zimbabweans are now naming different people associated with him. The Minister of Mines, Mr. Chitando, has been named. There is a case involving Wange Colliery Company. There is a report that's out where corruption was taking place in his presence, and he did nothing about it. He is a close confidant of the president. Mr. Joram Gumbo, also, who's seen as being close to the president, is also accused of corruption. Family members of the president are accused of corruption. So the feeling is that maybe the president, he of himself and his party, do not have the capacity to deal with the corruption, because the people making the accusations, some of them are even from the ruling party, the youth. The RPZ governor himself has been accused of corruption. So the thinking is the president and his party do not have the capacity to deal with the corruption because they themselves are engulfed by the corruption.
Taban Nari is a Zimbabwean who works with civil society groups inside Zimbabwe. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Dallas in Texas. A Nigerian High Court judge has ordered the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, the EFCC, to present the former chair of the Independent National Electoral Commission, for a bill hearing today, Friday. Maurice Iwu, the former Election Commission chief, was arraigned before the High Court in the commercial capital Lagos on Thursday for alleged corruption. He is accused of financial malfeasance estimated at $3.3 million, as well as money laundering. The EFCC says Iwu committed the offenses between December 2014 and March 2015, prior to the 2015 general election. Iwu has denied the charges. Minasra Ibrahim is a lawyer and human rights activist.
The prosecutory power on any crime in Nigeria lies with the Attorney General, which he has donated to the EFCC in this instance. I would say it's good, but not so excellent. It's good because it has shown that nobody is above the law, and no matter how long a crime is committed, definitely it will meet the rim of justice, no matter how long. Why I didn't say it's not so excellent is because of two reasons. The first reason is that they unnecessarily delay for up to 8 years. We should keep prompt delivery of justice as per the provision of Section 36 of the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. Justice delayed is justice denied. Then secondly, regarding the accusation, I wouldn't like to double into it because it's already before the court.
Some people are saying the prosecution, although it has lagged on for approximately 8 years, it's a fight against corruption that the government is undertaking and should be applauded. What do you say to that?
Yes, the fight against corruption fundamentally is a collective responsibility of all. Because the Constitution, Section 15, Subsection 5, gives provision regarding fight against corruption. The provision in that section of the Constitution says that it shall be a mandatory duty on all authorities and government on the state to fight corruption and abuse of office. That is the categorical provision. Now, if that is it, then it's a mandatory provision. It's a responsibility on you. There is nothing to applaud on what is already your responsibility. It is when you go extra miles to bring innovations, to bring certain things that are never, certain things that are unprecedented, then that's when issue of commendation will come about.
Critics of the government are saying that this is yet another indication that the former chairman is being persecuted after all these years. And why now, they said?
Yes, they have the liberty to really give their expression as per the provision of Section 39 of the Constitution. They have the liberty to express. But the point is that no matter how long it's a criminal offense or effort to have been committed, it is the responsibility of the government to dig it out and fairly go ahead into the streets.
Minasra Ibrahim is a Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Witnesses say fears of the Ebola virus have brought border traffic between Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo to a virtual standstill. Long lines and lengthy delays at the border crossings have left many traders frustrated. But officials say health checks are necessary to stop the spread of the Ebola virus. Yuji Uwimana has the story from the Rwanda-DRC border.
It's around 1 p.m. on Tuesday. We are on the Rwanda-DR Congo border. Traffic is heavy as usual, but the checks at the crossings have increased because of the Ebola virus. Beatrice Irunga, a 35-year-old Congolese trader, says workers are screening everyone for illness. She says you can't cross the border without washing hands and getting your temperature tested. The measures are necessary to prevent people from carrying the virus across the border. But trade-wise, Ebola fears have hit hard. Many bags of rice and jerry cans of oil are stored on the border. Jemima Ibrahim is a Congolese trader who sells rice and oil in Rwanda. She says the long delays at the crossing are costing her time and money. The loss is huge, she says. To buy goods here in Rwanda, to export them to Congo is becoming very hard. Claudine Irunga is a Rwandan woman who says she owns a shop in Goma on the Congolese side, but can't reach it because of the delays. I left Goma in the morning, she says. My shop is open now, and here they are not allowing us to go, regardless of every document you can have. I'm so sad. The Rwandan government estimates that 80,000 people cross between Goma and the Rwandan city of Gisenyi each day. The government has not said the border is closed, but it is urging its people not to enter the eastern DRC, where the Ebola virus has killed more than 1,800 people over the past year. Dr. Diane Gashumba is Rwanda's Minister of Health. She says the lines are very long, but what we even want most is to tell our people not to go to DRC. She says they can look for other ways to do their business in the country. This stance goes against advice from the World Health Organization. Dr. Kasonde Mulenga Mwinga is the WHO country director.
WHO does not advise on restrictions related to border control. WHO encourages that there is flow to the member country to be able to address the response that is needed in the country.
The Rwandan and Congolese health ministers met Tuesday to discuss measures to stop the Ebola outbreak from spreading. Ejene Uwimana for VOA News, Rubavu, Western Rwanda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 9th. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The UN Refugee Agency says more than 190,000 South Sudanese refugees have returned from refugee camps in neighboring countries. The agency says majority of the returnees are from Sudan. Ding Mangot reports from Juba.
UNHCR says more than 51,000 South Sudanese returned to South Sudan between January and July this year. Richard Ruati is the Assistant Internal Relations Officer at UNHCR.
Out of the 2.3 million South Sudanese refugees who are abroad, we have recorded 193,126 spontaneous refugees who are back in South Sudan.
UN Refugee Agency says the returnees have resettled in many areas, including Jonglei, Akobo, Fangak, and Pachola, where there is relative peace. Ruati says are settling back in their villages because of improved security in many parts of Sudan after the signing of the revitalized peace agreement in September last year.
There are two, three reasons they're coming back. For Sudan, actually, you know the crisis in Sudan now. There was a political crisis in Sudan. It's making some of them to come back because also they also cite the fact that the peace agreement in South Sudan is holding, especially in the areas of Upper Nile, Jonglei, and Unity, where people were very much displaced.
The Victoria region have recorded the highest number of returnees. Ruati says UNHCR is working with the other agencies, including the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission and the host communities, to identify opportunities for families returning home to resettle.
What we're talking about is the same support we're giving to IDPs and host communities who are already in the same situation that the refugee returnees are in. Because you also remember that like places like Bentiu or Upper Nile, when these returnees come, they integrate with the local community or the host community or even the IDPs who are in the POCs.
He says the returnees are coming from Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Central African Republic. Ruati says while UNHCR cannot guarantee the safety of returnees, the agency does not discourage voluntary repatriation. Says the refugee agency hopes the peace agreement will continue to hold to encourage more families to return home. UNHCR's household survey conducted in April to May this year found that 92% of the returnees say they will permanently resettle in South Sudan as long as the peace agreement continues to hold. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
Last week, officials seized more than 2 tons of cocaine and arrested 5 suspects off the coast of Cape Verde after what was considered the biggest seizure of cocaine in Cape Verde's history. Earlier this year, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime provided training to law enforcement. Muhammadu Kane is a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about the measures taken to combat drug trafficking in Cape Verde.
I think the main measure that had been taken was by the UNODC, who went there with some capacity building for the officers to help them better understand the dynamic and how this criminal operate, and also this forensic and how to investigate in order to really catch or to understand how they traffic the drug from Latin America to Europe, but also going through Cape Verde. Yeah. It was a very enriching training they had over the past month, yeah, which helped them a lot because they don't have many professional officers like specialized in drug trafficking, even if they have judiciary police, okay? But they are not very well capacitated. This is also another thing, another aspect that UNODC took into consideration, but also in the forensic investigation. I think this was also what I was told by these UNODC officials.
What kind of capacity did you find in your research that Cape Verde was lacking in forensic investigations when it comes to stopping drug trafficking?
They don't have enough training. Also, investigating about drug takes a long time. And for that, you might have a large network, but also enough materials, okay? Also, the fact that this officials or police officers or judiciary police doesn't have this capacity to really investigate is a problem, because even I remember when the drug was seized, okay, they immediately incinerated the next day because they were afraid, because they don't have a place where to store it, to keep it safely. They were impatient to burn it or to incinerate before the criminals come and get it, or before there is any other infiltration from the state, from the government, by the criminals who might also take it again. And because it happened again recently in Senegal, where they seized drug, but after some days we found the cocaine on the street of Dakar. So that's what they were afraid of. That's why they immediately, the next day, incinerated. Yeah.
So they lost some forensic evidence when they incinerated.
Exactly.
It.
So it means there's a lack of forensic really expertise, which I really believe that police officers, they need strong training, but also they need support from the international community.
Mohammed King is a researcher at the Institute for Security Studies. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. This year marks the 400th anniversary since the first enslaved Africans set foot in what is now the United States. The arrival in the British colony of Virginia in August 1619 of a ship carrying Africans from Angola marked the start of more than 200 years of slavery in America. Viewers Myra de la Salette and Betty Ayoub traveled to Angola to learn more about one of the origins of the transatlantic slave trade and its lingering impact on the region. Mara de la Salette, Nairis, the report.
In 1619, a European ship landed in colonial Virginia with an unexpected cargo, at least 20 enslaved Africans, the first in America. These captives, from what is now the country of Angola, had survived a treacherous Atlantic crossing, only to face more suffering, a fate shared by hundreds of thousands of other enslaved Africans in what became the United States. Records of the sale and shipment of Africans appear in many ledgers, telling a horror story of upheaval and exploitation. At Angola's National Museum of Slavery in Luanda, director Vladimir Fortuna says the slave trade's legacy still haunts the country.
For almost four centuries, this country, this region that we know today as Angola, was heavily involved in these activities, and this country was harmed in every single aspect. The social fabric was destroyed, and today we live with the consequences of slavery.
Centuries of colonial rule combined with slavery fostered conflicts in Africa that increased poverty and instability, Fortuna says.
The slave trade destabilized African societies. It wasn't possible during the times of slavery and colonization for African societies to reorganize their political and labor systems. And sometimes, people try to forget this part of the country's history. And that's why the National Museum of Slavery exists.
This small house and chapel overlooking the sea formed part of Luanda's slave trade. The beautiful view contrasts starkly with the deplorable experiences that happened here. In this building, captives were converted to Christianity before being sent to meet their fate as slaves in the New World. Through baptism, the Catholic Church stripped the captives of their African identity. Those who were detained in Angola were given Portuguese Christian names. Portugal officially banned slave trafficking in 1836, but Angola is still trying to recover from its legacy. Maida de la Salette with Betty Ayub, VOA News in Luanda, Angola.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Nigeria, where the country's vice president, Professor Yemi Osinbajo, says the federal government is excited about the prospect of Nigeria hosting the next FIFA Under 20 Women World Cup in 2020. Professor Osinbajo, who communicated these while receiving a delegation of FIFA inspection team, said that the federal government was actively supporting the bid of the Nigerian Football Federation to host the competition. The NFF president, Amaju Phoenix, said the FIFA delegation, who have been in Nigeria since Tuesday, had inspected 6 stadia, 13 training sites, 9 hospitals and no fewer than 10 hotels, and appeared to be very impressed with the facilities Nigeria is putting forward for the competition.
But we're also trying to push the narrative about Nigeria being a very safe country, being hospitable, being indeed the biggest economy in Africa. And you know, once this bid is granted, FIFA is going to invest millions upon millions of dollars.
Rhiannon Morton is the leader of the FIFA inspection team.
Nigeria has a massive reputation for great football. We've known that since FIFA has hosted events here in 99 and also in 2009 as well. Bringing a women's tournament here would obviously be very good for the development of women's football in Nigeria and in Africa as a whole as well. But as I say, the decision is still far from being taken, but we're very happy to be here and look at the great facilities on offer.
The decision on Nigeria's bid to host the event will be taken in September. Staying with women's football, South Africa will take on Zambia in the final of the 2019 COSAFA Women's Championship, the regional competition for Southern African countries, after both produced convincing victories in their semi-finals at the Wolfson Stadium on Thursday. Zambia brushed aside Botswana 4-0 in their last 4 clash before South Africa eased past Zimbabwe 3-1 as they stay on course for a 3rd title in succession after being crowned champions in 2017 and 2018. Away from women's football, Everton sealed the deadline day signing of Arsenal and Nigeria forward Alex Iwobi on Thursday for a reported fee of £34 million, completing a busy transfer window for the club on the final day of players' transfer in the English Premiership. The Nigerian international Alex Iwobi penned a 5-year deal, which was only announced more than 4 hours after the transfer deadline, which was the biggest incoming Premier League deal. The 23-year-old, capped 36 times by Nigeria, scored 15 goals in 149 appearances for Arsenal after making his first team debut in 2015. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. That's it for this Friday, August 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.